Good morning, everyone. I'd like to call this joint meeting of the House Special Committee on Tribal Affairs and the Standing Committee on Community and Regional Affairs to order. It is 8:03 a.m. on Tuesday, April 23rd in Capitol Room 106. Members present are Representative Thompson, Representative Jackson, Representative Drummond, Co-Chair of Community and Regional Affairs, Representative Hannon, Co-Chair for Community and Regional Affairs, Representative Kopp, Representative Lincoln, Representative Ortiz, Representative Vance, and myself, Representative Zolkowski, Chair. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Please take this time to silence your cell phones for the duration of the meeting. Before we begin, as always, I'd like to thank Julia Bushman, the Secretary from Records, and Doug Bridges from the Juneau LIO for staffing the committee today. Today, we will be hearing a presentation on the 2020 census from the Alaska Census Working Group. We already have our guests with us, Lori Wolf, President and CEO of 4-Acre Group, Katie Skovic with the Cook Inlet Housing Authority, and Eddie Hunsinger, State Demographer for the Department of Labor. I'd like to recognize that Speaker Edgman, Vice Chair of the Tribal Affairs Committee, has joined us. So if the members of the Alaska Census Working Group could put your names and affiliation on the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Chair Representative Zolkowski and the members of the House Tribal Affairs Committee. And thank you to co-chairs and House Committee on Community and Regional Affairs, Representative Drummond and Representative Hannon, and members of the committee. My name is Lori Wolf. I am the President and CEO of the 4-Acre Group, which serves as the State Nonprofit Association for Alaska and the Nonprofit Capacity Building Organization for Nonprofits and Tribes across Alaska. Central to our work is to give voice to nonpartisan public policy issues that affect Alaska's nonprofit sector. Our sector directly employs more than 44,000 Alaskans across the state. Nonprofits, big and small, new and mature, rely on census data to do their work. We get one chance every 10 years to get this right. That is why I am honored to be with you today. Thank you for the invitation. I am joined in the room by Eddie Hunsinger, State Demographer, and Katie Skovic with Public Policy Analyst at Cook Inlet Tribal Authority and member of the working group. I'd also like to recognize several people in the audience today. Mike Walsh, 4-Acre's Vice President of Public Policy, who provides support to the Alaska Census Working Group. Greg Bringhurst, Public Policy Director at Cook Inlet Housing Authority and member of the working group. And Barb Miranda with the U.S. Census Bureau, who is based in Juneau. I'd also like to acknowledge the remarkable relationship that we've had with the U.S. Census Bureau since we have begun our work. They are on the ground and here in D.C. We've just, they've been a wonderful partner in this effort.
I'm going to jump right in and recognize that Representative Klayman has joined us.
So a year and a half ago, the 4-Acre Group convened the Alaska Census Working Group with the intention of advocating for a fair and accurate count of Alaskans in the 2020 census. This nonpartisan, multi-sector collaboration with representation from business, local, state, and federal government, nonprofits, Alaska Native organizations, the University of Alaska, and others has been influential in building awareness among policymakers and the importance of the 2020 census, and has begun an active outreach necessary to ensure a fair and accurate count here in Alaska. It's important to point out that our primary motivation at the Alaska Census Working Group is the fairness and accuracy of the count, making sure that all Alaskans are counted. We are not focused on how the data is used once the count is complete beyond ensuring that all Alaska's data is used to ensure correct federal dollars and decisions flow to Alaska. We appreciate the opportunity to talk about the importance of a fair and accurate 2020 census count in Alaska, to discuss the specific enumeration issues that present challenges to such a count, and to talk about how together we can be a positive catalyst for making a fair and accurate count possible. We are often asked, why are you leading a group concerned about concerned Alaskans on an issue like this? And we say, well, we have 3.2 billion reasons why the census matters to Alaskans. This is the amount of funding currently received by our state from the federal government. That allocation is determined by the census, and I'm sure you would agree with us that we want Alaskans to receive their fair share. We also know that a healthy economy relies on accurate data. We get one chance every 10 years to get this data right. These two factors, federal dollars and good data on our state, have a deep impact on every Alaskan and gives us a strong incentive to get the count right. That said, there are a number of challenges we face. Here's a short list, and Katie will get into a lot more detail in a moment. The federal government has fewer resources available than we believe are needed for an accurate count in a place like Alaska. There will be fewer staff on the ground to help conduct the count. The Census Bureau's outreach efforts are lagging far behind the timeline we think is necessary to build awareness of the census and encourage Alaskans to participate. This is especially true since we know that trust is a central issue that requires a lot of communication far in advance of the effort. There will be no outreach to Alaskans whose only address is a post office box to alert people that the census is coming and to encourage their participation. This was studied in 2010 as an important step that was missed due to funding and will be missed again in the upcoming census efforts. There are no federal dollars set aside for translation of census materials into any of our Alaska Native languages. There is a much greater expectation that Alaskans will be able to respond online. Many will be able to do that, but as we know, many more do not have that kind of connectivity or even access to the internet. We do appreciate the headway that Census is making with hiring a census worker now in each Alaska village to do a paper count. That still leaves all of our more urban places with a mostly internet-based process. So what does this all mean? It means that we, as Alaskans, we must act. Again, I will note that it isn't just nonprofits that rely on census data. Businesses, tribes, and government at every level do too. It is simply the most important piece of data we have to make strategic decisions in this state and across the country. As we head towards the first count, in the U.S. and in Alaska in Tuksuk Bay, the Alaska Census Working Group is ready to stand with you to build awareness among policymakers at all levels of government and in our communities of the importance of a fair and accurate count. The concrete goals the working group is focused on currently is to create a web-based hub for communication for local complete count committees, to translate materials into Alaska Native languages, to provide a mini-grant program to incentivize local action, and to build trust through a post office box mailer. To be clear, this will conservatively take around $800,000 for these tasks. In other states, this effort is celebrated and led by the state, but that is not our situation. We have nothing to gain, personally at 4-Acre or the working group, to gain from this effort except an understanding that Alaska works best when government on all levels works together with nonprofits and private industry to help Alaskans.
Ms. Wolf, before you continue, can I ask a couple of clarifying questions?
You may.
Stepping back to the slide with the number, with the big $3.2 billion, yeah. I just want to make sure that I understand the challenges in front of Alaska in terms of our enumeration. So the difference between the 2020 census and the 2010 census is that there's no heads-up mailing that will be sent in advance of the count to PO boxes around the state, as well as materials will not be translated to native languages, and it's an online-only response for enumeration. Is that correct?
It's not an online-only response, but it is the Census Bureau is mostly going to an online response. There will be a paper response as well, and Katie and Eddie will get more into the details about that. We've just gotten a little bit more update about that even yesterday.
Great, thank you. And then stepping forward back to the slide about the first count proudly being in District 38, when you were talking about the work of the complete count committees, those are established throughout Alaska communities and is estimated to cost about $800,000. Is that correct?
No, the work that we are proposing to do that I just mentioned, those things that we are proposing to is about an $800,000 effort. The complete count committees are self-funded at the local level. I don't have an estimate for that.
Thank you. Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You've referenced several times, you use the words fair and accurate, with the understanding that there could be a lack of fairness or a sense of lack of fairness in relationship to no materials provided in the original native languages. Is there any other element that would make up your definition of fair? Which, when you keep saying fair, in what way would it, other ways would it not be fair, potentially not be fair?
Through the chair, thank you. I think there's a number of ways that it won't be fair. It could not be fair. When we'll show you a map shortly of how Alaska was counted in 2010. And what I like to say is we're one big red dot, meaning that we're just a very, very hard to count state on a well-funded day at the federal level and at the state level. And so there are the less resources that we put, the less resources that the Census Bureau puts, the less likely we will count people. And when we talk about fairness, we talk about counting every Alaskan, no matter how hard or difficult it is to count them. And it is just a very difficult time and place in our geography to count people. So the tendency is to go to urban spaces, to use online tools, to put less resources in harder to count places, and that seems less fair.
Thank you for that. So accuracy is the big part of
it. Accuracy is a huge part of that, yes.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, through the chair. Ms. Wolf, could you elaborate on the $800,000 that you've mentioned? Where are we in the status of funding that? Has the state committed money to it? What additional revenues are needed?
Thank you. Through the chair, that is a budget that we have put together just ourselves in what we believe all of that effort that I have noted would require. So that's a number that we at the working group have put together. We have been trying to raise that money through private sources because there is no public source for that funding currently. We have previously advocated for funding at the state level. To our knowledge, that is not currently happening. So that is private at the moment. We have not met that budget. Right now, 4-Acre has been contributing in-kind time, as well as Kukulent Housing Authority has been contributing in-kind time as well. And we have received, there's a small collaboration of national private funders from major foundations across the country who have recognized that Alaska is a hard-to-count state and prioritized $175,000 to our state through the working group for some of those efforts. So we continue to raise private philanthropy, but we can talk more about in the rest of the presentations about how other states are funding this. And we believe that in Alaska, if the state was going by other calculations in other states, it's, I just need to get this number in front of me, but I think it's about it's 1.5 million that the state of Alaska could allocate if it was mirroring other states' same formula for how it funds its population in the census.
One follow-up.
Do you know, through the chair, do you know in previous census how Alaska has funded? Has the state contributed public dollars in previous censuses? And
they have.
How did we do that?
I'm going to defer to Eddie. Do you know the number?
Through the chair, I don't have the number, but there was in it. I was sort of in and out of the state around between 2008 and 10, but I do recall that there were funds set aside specifically for complete count work through the state that our office at the Department of Labor worked with, and but I'd have to follow up and get the numbers for you, Representative.
Thank you. Thank you. Please continue.
So I was just going to follow up on what we believe the concrete things that we're working on. I think I mentioned a website-based communication hub for the complete count committees, translating those materials. And this will all, again, be kind of through, you know, as many partnerships as we can muster here. Again, a mini grant program and that post office box mailing. And so Katie's going to spend some more time kind of talking about some of the challenges that we face. And then Eddie will talk more specifically about the count itself. And then I'll come back.
For the record, my name is Katie Skovic, Senior Policy Analyst with Cook Inlet Housing and member of the Working Group. Thank you to the chairs of both committees for having us here today. I'm going to pick up where Lori left off talking about some of the specific challenges to counting Alaska. As Lori mentioned, there's clearly the biggest loss or potential loss here is reduced federal funding, especially in light of constrained state and local budgets. If there isn't an accurate count in 2020, there will also be a lack of accurate data, not only for governments and nonprofits, but also for private businesses and tribal entities to plan for the future. And so when you talk to private businesses, this goes to anything from should we open a grocery store in a certain village to should we add another flight route through Alaska Airlines. And so this data plays a critical role, as Mr. Hunsinger will speak to, sort of for the government side, for nonprofits, as Lori has mentioned, but also for private businesses. Census data also influences the enforcement of voting and civil rights laws, and so an accurate count is important to how those laws are enforced. And then just to reiterate that every person who goes uncounted in Alaska, and if there is an undercount in Alaska, will lead to a reduction in essential services that range from road repairs to education to housing to food assistance. And this sort of spans all of the federal programs that Alaska receives resources for. And when you talk to Census Bureau officials, it's clear that Alaska is a particularly challenging state to count. You are all aware of the geographic barriers in the state. Much of Alaska requires special counting methods, some of which are used only in this state and nowhere else in the country. There are language barriers in that, as Lori mentioned, the census forms will be translated into 14 languages, including English. None of those languages are Alaska Native languages or many of the other languages that are spoken here in the state. Barriers to connectivity. Not all of Alaska will be asked to fill out their census form online, but this is something to sort of track and keep an eye on as the census continues to move in that direction. And then there's also a prevalence of hard-to-count populations, populations that across the country and in Alaska we know are more difficult to reach and more difficult to count. So to give an image of what makes Alaska so hard to count, I think it helps to start with a map of the lower 48. And the basic message here is that any area that is white on this map is sort of your standard, regular, easy to count tract according to the Census Bureau. And then any tract that's in the yellow to red colors is hard to count, meaning that census response rates in 2010 were below average. And so red being the hardest to count, white being the easiest to count. And what you see here is that most of the lower 48 of these large areas of white where sort of the census will mail out a form or mail out a reminder and ask people to either fill out their form by mail or online or by phone. And that process just runs as sort of the standard census mail out, mail back process. When you look at Alaska, the map looks a lot different. The important thing to note here is that all of the striped areas up to the west and north are called special enumeration tracts. Those areas are so difficult to count that they require special counting methods. And so what I think is helpful here is to imagine those striped areas as an even darker shade of red. And so when you think about it that way, Alaska looks almost like an inversion of the lower 48. You have most of the geographic areas of the state are especially hard to count and require special counting methods. We also know that certain groups and areas of the state are especially at risk of being undercounted because of sort of the post-mortem work that the Census Bureau does to estimate their undercounts. So those striped areas in this last slide, the special enumeration tracts, we know in 2010 that those were undercounted by 8%, which is a pretty staggering number when you think of the federal dollars that are tied to each person uncounted in those places and the need for federal resources in those places. We also know this is a national figure, but we know that there was almost 5% undercount of American Indians and Alaska Natives living on reservations or tribal lands in 2010. And so when you put those two numbers together, thinking about those living in tribal lands in these special enumeration districts, we know that that population is especially at risk of undercount and those areas especially at risk of losing out on resources. Also at risk of undercount, we know there are other groups such as renters, children under the age of 5, Alaskans experiencing homelessness, and also people living in overcrowded housing situations, which again speaks to sort of remote rural areas of the state. And a big part of that is, or a big part of the work that we need to do is to educate people and do outreach in those communities, especially to let people know that it's safe to participate in the census and that that data is kept confidential. So if someone is living in an extremely overcrowded housing situation, we were in a meeting yesterday, we were talking about people living in housing units with 18 people living in them, and knowing that you can safely disclose that information to the census and that that's actually a good thing because your community will receive resources tied to housing, healthcare, all of those things, is going to be a big piece of the outreach, is sort of breaking down the distrust or fear that that information will be used in some form of retribution to people living in those situations.
Representative Edgman.
Good morning. So talking about being undercounted, there's also sort of specific circumstances like the workers at Prudhoe Bay being counted in House District 40 or the seafood processors in House District 37 being counted. And so there's sort of countervailing, you know, or other circumstances where you actually have perhaps overcounting too. So I just wanted to put that out there.
Yes, and that's through the chair. That's another piece that makes Alaska especially hard to count is seasonal work and sort of the migration between places. And that's actually one of the reasons that the count starts early in Alaska, both needing to physically get out to places where you might need a snow machine. And some of these sort of concepts are sort of foreign to people coming from the Census Bureau, that you might need a snow machine to actually go out and interview people and count them. But then also figuring out when will people be in their sort of place of their normal place of residence is another major challenge.
Ms. Kovic, before you get you advance too far, you'd mentioned on the previous map about the difficult about Alaska being one of the hardest states to count, and particularly needing to require special enumeration or special counting methods. Can you define what that means?
Sure, I can briefly here, and then I actually have a couple slides that goes through the four different counting methods and how you can sort of look up your district and figure out specifically how your district will be counted in 2020. The main message here is that for these striped areas, those will all be counted with in-person counting methods. It's known as the remote Alaska operation in those areas. And that means that census enumerators are actually on the ground in villages working with the plan is to hire enumerators or counters in each village to assist with that process, to sort of have both the local trusted source and actually have someone who can verify, oh, I know so-and-so lives here, and have that more personal element to be able to get around from place to place. And so that's a very intensive, time-intensive, and resource-intensive counting process. But as Lori mentioned, the goal of the census is to count everyone regardless of where they live and how difficult it is to count them. So
thank you. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, through the chair. So the mention of none of the forms being translated into indigenous languages is really gnawing at my brain, especially when we reflect on those statistics. And I'm wondering how that intersects with on-the-ground enumerators. Is the attempt, and help me understand, if those enumerators who are staff speak the indigenous language, is it critical the materials be translated, or is it better to have the materials translated into an indigenous language and having that conversation? And I assume the best case scenario is both translated materials and a fluent speaker at your door, and that's the dream candidate for the job that we don't have in all communities.
Through the chair, I think that's a great question. I think to the language piece, I think we know specifically that outreach materials need to be translated because we won't have that sort of boots on the ground person delivering those mailers or handouts to actually explain what the census is and that it's safe to participate. So we know translation of the messaging is important there. I think your question, I think staff from the Census Bureau would probably best be able to answer that, but my sense is that the ideal, as you mentioned, would to have translated materials and have a translator. The reality is that we likely won't have translated materials, and so working from that assumption, it will be critical to find enumerators in each village that are fluent in English and can work with Census Bureau staff as well as local languages and can help in that process. But it's an intensive hiring process to find people that meet those qualifications, and so one of our goals at the working group, or one of our highest sort of budget priorities, is translation, because we can't sort of guarantee that we will have that on the ground translation piece in person.
One follow up.
In previous censuses, have we translated or have translated into indigenous language materials been readily available? And that's a, is that a change at the federal level or state?
Through the chair, Eddie Hunsinger, Representative Hand. I don't believe that, so I wanted to clarify on that too, especially for communication with the Census Bureau. I don't believe that in previous censuses the Census Bureau had translated outreach materials in indigenous languages for Alaska, but it's something that I think we should work to get somehow for Alaska, because I think it's going to help ensure that we get complete counts. And also with the P.O. Box outreach, I don't believe that we put together a plan for P.O. Box outreach with 2010, but that didn't go through as Ms. Wolf described. But I think it's something that will help the state get complete counts for 2020, and it'll affect us all the way through the next decade. So I hope that's helpful.
I just go ahead. Through the chair, we did learn yesterday that we can get you the numbers, but we learned that it is the number of translations are down, and that is a federal decision, not a local decision, not a statewide decision. And so we can get you the list of what they did in 2010 versus what they did in 2020. They noted that yesterday. I think we also heard yesterday from some communication folks at the Bureau that the census workers themselves, they can't tell you how to fill out the form. So what we're focused on is the outreach materials before the census happens, not the census form itself.
So really briefly before you continue, can you talk about who funds the local enumerators, whether that's state or federal funding or a combination of both?
Through the chair, my knowledge is that all of the Census Bureau staff, those will be federal employees who will go through the regular federal employment process of background checks and all of that, and that's all done through, there's an Alaska office that works, and then there's sort of hub offices around the state. And so that hiring will be done through the federal government, but at the state and local level.
Thank you. Please continue.
I think the final thing I wanted to acknowledge on this slide is that the risk of undercount is present in both rural and urban areas of the state. Because racial and ethnic minorities are overrepresented in some of these groups, such as the population of people experiencing homelessness, people living in overcrowded housing situations, renters, there is also a risk of being undercounted in those urban areas, and I just wanted to acknowledge that even when you sort of zoom into a place like Anchorage or Juneau or Fairbanks in Alaska, you have tracts that are harder to count than in other areas of the country. So I just wanted to point that out as well. So to further highlight how difficult Alaska is to count and sort of what the Census Bureau has done with their enumeration methods in response to that, the typical census method of response is self-response or mail out, mail back, and that's those white areas of the country, most of the lower 48. You can picture the census form will be mailed, or you'll receive a prompt in the mail asking you to complete your census form, and the options for that are either by mail, especially pushing online in 2020, or by phone. In Alaska, this does cover the majority of households in places like Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau. And so that's sort of your business as usual, receive a census form or prompt and then complete your census and self-response, no contact with a Census Bureau staff member. But then Alaska, because of the unique geographic needs and also the fact that many areas of the state don't have your sort of standard home mail addresses, requires additional unique counting methods. And so what's known as the update leave method is where census enumerators or counters are on the ground. They deliver census materials at your doorstep, and they sort of verify and correct their address list as they go. And then from that, you'll receive at your door rather than through a mailbox as you would in Anchorage or other places, a prompt to fill out the census. And that happens for about 60,000 households in Alaska in places like Valdez, Bethel, and Nome. The third type of counting method used in Alaska is called update enumerate. And this is a boots on the ground. Census enumerators go door to door and actually count people at their place of residence. So it's a door to door, face to face interaction where people are being interviewed. And this happens mostly in Southeast, about 4,000 households in that area of the state. And then finally, what sort of really highlights the uniqueness of Alaska is the fact that there is this remote Alaska operation, which is I think there are around seven different enumeration methods that the census uses, and one of those is just for Alaska specifically. This is where enumerators go door to door, the same as they do in the update enumerate method. They count people at their places of residence, and then the information here is verified by someone in the village. And so this is where the census will be hiring enumerators in villages to go around and actually assist with that count. So this is a more sort of collaborative, in-person, time-intensive process at the local level. And this is actually used for 30,000 households across the state, up in northern, western Alaska, and then also the Aleutians.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In relationship to the enumerators that go door to door, do they have specific, have to see face-to-face, have some sort of signature in the people that they count, or can they use local knowledge about, oh, this person does live here, they just happen to be gone for whatever reason, and we just know that? Are they allowed to use that kind of information as a part of their count, or do they actually have to make some sort of physical eye contact signature kind of thing?
Through the chair, I'll answer first, and then I'll defer to Mr. Hunsinger to correct me if I'm off base. But I believe the first attempt is an in-person attempt where you are actually working to meet this person face-to-face. I believe there are follow-up attempts, and then at a certain point, if that person has not been reached, you are able to use sort of neighbors and other local people in the area to sort of help you either locate people or help to sort of fill out that form and figure out who's in the community. So it, after a certain point, can become a sort of more collaborate with neighbors, check and verify that work.
Thank you.
Please continue.
So then just at the bottom of this slide here, this link that you should have hopefully in your slides as well lets you look at your district specifically. You can sort of zoom into the map, select your house district, and it'll both tell you who was undercounted in your community and in your district in 2010, and also how your district will be counted in 2020. And our sense of the working group is one of the big pieces of outreach here is just letting people know what's going to happen when the census comes, because it's one thing to tell people that the 2020 census is coming, but what does that really mean, and how do we make that sound like a less scary thing than the federal government is knocking on your door? And so being able to say, so we here in District 38, we will be counted using in-person counting methods, so you should expect to see someone from the community as well as the Census Bureau staff coming around, it's safe to participate. And so knowing how your area will be counted and being able to then communicate to residents in the district, I think is an important piece of that outreach. So that's a really great resource at the bottom of the page there. And then just to dig into a little bit of the timeline in remote Alaska, that remote Alaska operation will again begin in Tuksuk Bay on January 21st. That operation will continue through the end of April. And so the Census Bureau informed us yesterday that there's three waves to that. The first wave will be in western Alaska. It will then move to northern Alaska. And then finally, you'll have the Aleutians and Glen Allen and the surrounding areas there counted. And so this is sort of a phased, ongoing process over about 3 months in 2020. And that's all taking place earlier than the count in much of the rest of the country, just to account for the difficulty of reaching those places and seasonality and all of those things.
I'll just take a point of privilege to invite all of my colleagues to District 38 for the start of the 2020 census.
You have a good session there.
Maybe we'll call a special session there.
Yeah.
Please continue.
And then just finally to highlight again that the plan that we were informed of is that the Census Bureau will hire and train an enumerator in each village to help conduct that door-to-door count. And that information will again be reviewed and certified by a village leader. And so the Census Bureau has been an active partner in this and trying to really dig down and work at the local level. And so while we're acknowledging a pretty significant undercount in 2010 and wanting to identify the ways that we combat that in 2020, also just recognizing that the Census Bureau is out in Kotzebue. They are working around this week for focus groups, and they're working around the state to really figure out the same end goal as we have, which is an accurate count of everyone in the state and in the country.
Representative Jackson.
Thank you, through the chair. So on this page, the process, this is done by the federal government, which hires local people, and they pay pretty good, too. To do the count, so based on this page alone, where they're working with people in the different communities, it sounded like it was really, really difficult up until this page. And it's like, okay, they break it down to different areas. They will have someone in each community helping them, which language, right, will be able to be assisted also. So I'm just curious, do we have a fear, like locally, that the federal government won't do their job properly, hence reinforcement of us spending like $800,000 to do also?
Through the chair, my sense is that I think rather than thinking that the Census Bureau will do their job improperly, it's recognizing that their job is especially hard in Alaska, and that even when they do sort of all of these steps, if you're at the door in a remote area and you're counting an overcrowded housing unit and you miss two people in that unit, and that sort of plays out across communities or whatever the specific case may be, that when you aggregate that, you do add up into a pretty significant undercount. And so I think the idea with outreach is being anything we can do to bolster their efforts is going to be beneficial, especially in just letting people know what the census is and that it's safe to participate in all of those messaging.
Follow up.
Thank
you, through the chair. It almost sounds like this is something new or a new process, but this has been going on for as long as we've been around, right? But you're seeing that there's something different or a greater fear now than there used to be. Why is the greater fear now than it used to be?
Through the chair, I think there are a couple layers to that. I think sort of a widespread distrust of government can be a piece of that, especially federal government. I think when you talk to Census Bureau staff, talking about data privacy, which I think Mr. Hunsinger will get into more, has become a more sort of prevalent, widespread concern, especially when you're talking about online forms, people concerned about what happens with online data. And so I think these broader trends are feeding in to sort of individual people's fears at the local level, and that's driving some of this as well.
May I offer as well, through the chair, that the census has been fairly dramatically underfunded at the federal level this time around, and so they have also been very slow to get up to step. And so their lagging impacts Alaska probably more significantly because we are the first state to be counted. So it's a trickle-down problem into our state that is causing us greater concern than in years before.
Representative Kopp, and then you. Representative Kopp, and then Representative Vance.
Thank you for your presentation. Question I had on being able to a couple things. So first, is there a residency requirement when you say who is living here, or how do you define that question? I was just reading the sample spreadsheet. So what are you looking at for residency when you count someone?
Through the chair, the most basic definition is where a person spends the majority of their time during a year. So that applies to seasonal workers, that applies to college students. And so that's sort of the very baseline definition of residency that the Census Bureau uses. I'm sure they would explain a much more sort of complicated process.
Okay.
But
follow up.
So do you think it's possible to partner with the Permanent Fund Division? It's the most accurate data set we have on all Alaskans, and it will have just the application period will have just finished March 31st. It's where law enforcement always goes when we want to find somebody. I know there's probably rules about information sharing. The other list for hard to count areas would be maybe going to the corporations, Native corporations, and seeing if there's some shareholder information so that you're not walking in with a blank data set. You know, you actually can at least cross-check known data points that are relatively fresh. But again, I don't know what all the information sharing hurdles are with that.
Through the chair, I'll start and then again turn it over to Mr. Hunsinger, who knows a lot about this. But yes, the Census Bureau has looked into using administrative data either to sort of supplement their work, or if you could run just a census based on administrative data that was highly accurate. That's not where the census is today. And I think there are also concerns with some people are missed in the permanent fund dividend as well. And so it's sort of, we don't have a perfect tool, and that can't really replace the census in terms of capturing where people are on a certain day of the year, because that's sort of the broad picture that the census captures. But that's something that Census Bureau is looking into, whether that would be a much more efficient and accurate process potentially.
Okay, and just one more, I'm sure.
Final follow-up.
Because there's not, it, like you say, it's hard to incentivize people for various reasons on the census, but there's very high incentive on the PFD. So you, it might be a harder number. Anyway, thank you, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. Maybe I'll just try through the chair. You know, and Eddie can speak more directly to the how this all works, but there's a lot of efforts that go forth in that cross-tabbing of where people live, and all of that all has been happening for more than almost 2 years now, even more. And Eddie can describe that in the PFD data and the regional corporations, and those are all accessed, and as well as local addresses. All of that has been part of the process already, so they're not starting from scratch. So just to assure, maybe just take away that fear, they're not starting from scratch. There's lots and lots of efforts. It takes them 10 years to do this, and of course outlined by the Constitution how they have to do it. I will say there's a key piece of data that that Katie often shares that I think is important, because when we talk about kind of, well, maybe we just miss 1%, or maybe we just miss, you know, and you know, because there's no perfect current source of data out there. It's just good to know that for the data that we have is that for every Alaska Native person who's not counted, that's $3,000 a year times 10 years. Mm-hmm. So this is, you know, 1% matters, right? That 1% that we don't get in the PFD, that matters to Alaska. So that's why we're trying to have a complete count. And we currently, and well, this is mandated by the U.S. Constitution, but we also have no other complete count of every Alaskan.
Representative Vance.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think Representative Kopp's recommendation for the PFD was along my train of thought of, you know, Alaskans have a big motivation to complete their PFD. If you could work with the state to provide a link directly to your census and work with your partners to, you know, we all get excited when we hear the rumor that Alaska Airlines might be, you know, giving away a couple of airline tickets, you know, if you get in the drawing, if you complete your census or something, because we know that the majority of Alaskans will be doing online PFDs that may help in the process, but also working with the state to perhaps do some of the translating for the online applications may be a way, an inexpensive way to partner to provide, you know, some of the language assistance to help these Alaskans in a streamlined manner. You know, there's a lot of ways that we could partner that wouldn't cost a lot of money and would have it already in hand for 10 years from now if it was something that was produced online. But just a flashback, a little historical point with the census. One of my friends in Anchor Point, Fred Agri, him and one other man were the last people to do census by dog sled up in Denali because of the trust factor. The last time that people were up there trying to get a census, they were chased off with chased off their property and were not welcomed. And so they decided that a less invasive way that the community would accept them was on dog sled. And he's one of our Iditarod finishers. But I thought that was shows how the Census Bureau does tackle Alaska, meeting the people in a way that they find the least invasive and acceptable to get these numbers. But I just wanted to address more of the trust factor, because I noticed that my district is also one of the very red areas, and I think part of it is because door knocking is not welcome in my district. People get creeped out by it. I think I door knocked 2 times, and I myself had someone saying that they were coming for a census, and oh, thank you, you know, and it just felt like a big invasion of privacy, and I live right in town. And I think that's something that Alaskans still don't want to share their information. Are there ways that we can get over that and show the importance of this data, like you said, and not being afraid that our privacy is being invaded.
Through the chair, so the Census Bureau sort of released this, what they call their census barriers, attitudes, and motivators study, and they do all these focus groups, and they talk to people about why wouldn't you fill out the census, what do you know about the census, and the three big messaging pieces that they identify is that people don't really know what the census is, they don't know what that means that the census is happening, they don't understand what the census is used for and that it's important in terms of federal funding and making our communities look the way we want them to look and investing in our local areas. And then finally, they don't believe or know that the census cannot share that data. And it's a federal crime for Census Bureau officials to share any personal data. And so that is kept very secure. But people on the ground don't know or believe that. And so breaking down those three barriers, the Census Bureau has identified as the most important piece. And I think to speak to that last piece, the messenger is really important as well. I think having sort of a federal mailer arrive on your doorstep is not going to induce a lot of trust of, oh, of course this is safe to fill out. But if you have someone in your local community who can step up and say, this matters a lot and the census is safe to participate in and I'm filling out the census because of this, I think that personal connection starts to help break down some of those barriers.
Thank you. I want to take a moment to recognize that Representative Christ Tompkins has joined us. Representative Hannon.
Thank you. And this is more a comment than a question for our panel, but I guess in my thinking, the Alaskans who participate in the PFD are already the people that we likely would get a census response from. They have some stability, they're forthright with response to government, and I think it's the vast majority of others who are in Alaska who may not be eligible for the PFD or they're life is disrupted in some other way, whether it's mental illness or migratory status or homelessness. Those are the people that we worry about not capturing. But the PFD people who do that, who have, you know, Alaskans who are clued in enough, they already trust that the government has a connection and they're willing to share some data. So I'm not worried about them being missed. It's the others who are in residence in Alaska that we need to focus on capturing, because that's our 8% that we're missing.
Please continue.
Through the chair, I think that we are now going to turn it over to Mr. Hunsinger to speak more to all that is great about the census.
Before you move on,
yes.
If you could go back to the previous presentation. The following slide, I was waiting to ask a question.
So the following slide?
Yes.
I believe, are
yeah,
you?
I can.
Yeah.
Sure. I was hoping under the Alaska Census Working Group, from what I understand, the governor, the previous administration and then the current governor both had issued administrative orders related to the census, and I was hoping you could speak to what those administrative orders kind of directed and what the intention and purpose of them are.
Through the chair, I can attempt to do that, and feel free, my colleagues can join me in that. So I can speak to the to both of them kind of overall and potentially some of the differences in them. So the Walker administration put out an administrative order to create a complete count commission for the state. For true transparency, I was appointed to that, that the idea was that it was focused on the count itself, and it had a lot of connection to the Alaska Census Working Group. There are 9 ways that the new executive order is different. I'm happy to elaborate on those as you'd like. It is in the governor's prerogative to rescind an administrative order and reissue their own. That's their in their purview. I can't speak exactly to the new administrative order's intent. It has not yet met, and the composition is dramatically different than the last one.
Can you speak? Can you speak to the initial administrative order 301 and what it established and what you understood as part of the working group, what it was intended to accomplish?
Yeah, the intent was to work on the communication effort prior to the census, very much like the work in partnership with the Alaska Census Working Group. It cited our efforts, and it cited the ability to broaden the scope and to really have the state backing of the efforts of the communication outreach around the count itself.
And can you talk a little bit about how Administrative Order 303 is different and how that might shift and change the outcomes of the work that's being done from the state's perspective?
So I can't speak from the state's perspective, but I can speak to the ways that it's different that we can see in the write-up. Again, the group hasn't met yet, so we haven't seen any action. But in particular, it removes the Alaska Census Working Group as a partner. The chair was a designated person from the working group. That is no longer the case. In this case, the governor has designated a chair. It removes the Alaska Municipal League appointee and calls for a mayor or municipality from the state. It removes the governor's Tribal Advisory Council recommendation seat. It removes someone from regional healthcare organization seat. It removes a seat that was assigned to both the House and the Senate. It moved the Complete Count Commission to the Department of Administration rather than the Department of Commerce. It removes references to a timeline and an expected workflow. The original AO had a clear timeline and workflow of deliverables. That is not in the new AO. And it removes some of the protocols around the meetings as well that were in the first AO.
So I absolutely recognize the governor that different administrations have their own prerogatives when it comes to issuing administrative orders and the intent of what those are. Can you speak to maybe how we've talked a lot this morning about accuracy and fairness of the count and making sure that we have adequate representation in an effort that is underfunded by almost $1 million? Can you talk about how maybe some of these structural changes of this particular working group might impact or change what our outcomes are?
I can attempt to do that. I think, I mean, one thing I'll say, and then I'll let Katie speak to it as well, which is, you know, I think for this committee might be particularly concerned that the undercount is, again, a lot in remote and rural Alaska. There's no current representation in the new AO group that has that area of expertise. And so, again, particular to this group, you might be that might be a moment of concern. You want to say some more?
Through the chair, just to elaborate on what Ms. Wolf said, I think a major point here is not so much about the composition of the new commission, but just not having a lot of information on its intent and what it's set up to do. I think very clearly in the first administrative order, there was talk about a complete count and outreach and all of those sort of before the count components. And I think there's been somewhat of a reframing towards what happens once the count has been completed and what that data is used for. And as a group that's very concerned about how do we get an accurate count in the first place, I think that's a big difference between the two.
I can also, thank you through the chair, I can also speak to that as well, which is that in the original, in the Walker budget, there was $250,000 that was connected to the work of the Complete Count Commission for the state. That was taken out of the new proposed budget of the governor's budget, and $1 million was placed in this governor's budget around reapportionment or redistricting. So again, it's more about what you're going to do with the data than collecting the data itself, which was our original intent.
So I just want to clarify before we move on. So looking at the structural differences between the compositions that were published within both administrative orders is shifting potentially from making sure that there's an accurate count at the front end throughout the process and instead focusing resources at the back end for how that information is being used. Am I to understand that there's maybe some concern within the stakeholder community, within the public-private partnership of people who have been participating in the census working group, that instead of focusing resources to ensure accuracy of account, it is in how to use the data at the back end? Is that correct?
Through the chair, that is our understanding.
Thank you. Representative Hannon.
Thank you. Through the chair, I noticed that the governor's census count commission under Executive Order 8303 does have Mr. Hunsinger on it. And I assume, because this does not delineate in the listing that I have from them, but I assume you're the Department of Labor designee, and it has three other state designations. Are there any other members that the governor appointed that also serve on the census working group, or are you the only crossover member?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, I've worked with the Alaska Census Working Group trying to provide information. I just want, you know, complete and accurate data for Alaska in the 2020s. And I believe I'm the only one who's on the. I believe I'm the only one who's on both of the administrative orders, and the only one that's participated. I can't think of any offhand, other folks offhand that have participated to provide information and support the efforts of the working group and all Alaskans to help ensure complete counts for Alaska.
Thank you.
Thank you. Please continue.
So Eddie will speak some more to the specifics, but maybe I'll just make my ask and then turn it over to him. So, you know, we have four requests of you today, and you've heard some of these already, so I'll just reiterate here. We do need your help in building trust. There are lots of ways to do that. We encourage all of you, and many of them are free, so we encourage all members of the Senate and House to educate your constituents about the importance of the count in your district in particular. And in particular, one of the ways to build trust is to talk about how that data actually created positive change in your region. And we're happy to help you with that data if that is helpful for you. There are lots of low-cost or no-cost activities like sending messages to your constituents and talking about these issues in any of your town halls and encouraging participation through a notice in the PFD application. That's a great way to help, again, build some trust. It will also be wonderfully helpful if you could get the word out about the staffing opportunities that the census is doing in your region. We know in particular, we heard yesterday, they're having a very difficult time hiring in Bethel. And so we'd love for them to be able to hire all across the region. So helping get the word out about those opportunities would be wonderful. You can help mobilize local complete count committees in your region. We have a list of the current complete count committees. But we would love to see lots more of them happening at the local level. And again, we're here to support them, as is the U.S. Census Bureau. We would like you to advocate for state funding of the effort to on the communication side. We still believe that the state should fund the should be part of funding the count, and especially on the communication side, and because there is a significant lack of funding on the outreach end. And again, I mentioned that if we were to use a similar calculation of other states, that might actually look like $1.5 million given by the state of Alaska to the effort if we wanted to be on par with other states per population base. And we hope that you will utilize the resources from our working group. We're trying our best to provide lots of free information to you and be available to you as helpful. We are doing a lot and as much as we can, but we don't think we should do it alone, and we cannot do it alone. This is our other life. We all have other lives. This is the we've devoted our time and energy to census because we believe so strongly in it. But the state has so much at stake in an accurate count. Then the working group is just merely a supplement and a complement to the state's efforts. We cannot supplant all the efforts that the state provides and the U.S. Census Bureau provides. So again, I just encourage you that to work with us as partners across the state for a count. And we'll turn it over to Eddie, who's going to give us some wonderful detail here.
And, through the chair, I wanted to also following up a little bit more on the complete count commission, I haven't received communication that there's been sort of a shift in focus or anything like that. We haven't had a meeting, but I don't know myself of any sort of change in focus for the complete count commission. I also wanted to follow up on a couple of points. I'll start with Representative. My name's Eddie Hunsinger, for the record. Representative Kopp and Representative Vance both mentioned PFD data, and the Census Bureau has been in touch with the Department of Revenue to going back a couple years. They have a Census Administrative Records Program to help find ways they can utilize information to ensure complete counts. And they do this administrative records program with, you know, diverse admin data across the country. And also, another Representative Vance, you mentioned using the PFD to, you know, help get response. I imagine that the Census Bureau would find that very difficult to actually do direct response. But in working group meetings, the working group I know has discussed using the, and with state partners, using the PFD to do outreach, to say, you know, get the word out about the census. So that's something that I thought was really helpful from the working group. And then I also wanted to note, to respond, Representative Jackson spoke earlier about sort of how things are looking for the census, and many, and this goes back to sort of differences between 2010 and 2020. And the census is, there are a lot of similarities that give us confidence. And the Alaska Census Working Group worked with us to help ensure that we have these types of enumeration areas that aren't drastically modified to hurt counts. We were very concerned a few years back. That's what really energized me, you know, about the census. We were very concerned that they were going to change some ways that they would do the counts throughout Alaska more dramatically than we would like. And they were looking at a new way to count people across the country that I think could have hurt Alaska quite a bit. But working with the Alaska Census Working Group, and really from our office, working with the Census Bureau, we were able to keep these types of review and keep these types of enumeration areas, and we're very thankful to the Census Bureau, to the working group, and through and to my colleagues at the Alaska Department of Labor to keep those. But Representative Jackson, there one thing that there is a difference that we are very concerned about is the Census Bureau's investment in non-response follow-up, and that's one reason that we are concerned that we get better outreach. And that we get more materials in languages that we have a lot of speakers of in Alaska, and that we utilize post office boxes for outreach. And so these efforts, I think, are still very important, unique from 2010, because if the Census Bureau is not investing as much in, I said, non-response follow-up, that's when people don't respond. We have a lot of folks who don't respond on the first pass. If that happens, the Census Bureau has to go out again, and they might go out fewer times this census. So it's all the more important, and that's one reason that we really want to focus on stronger efforts for 2020 on outreach.
I want to take a moment to recognize that Representative Fields has joined us.
So addressing the committee through the chair, good morning, and thank you for inviting me to talk about the 2020 census today. Again, my name is Eddie Hunsinger. I'm state demographer for the Alaska Department of Labor. So I work with colleagues. I have two colleagues at Department of Labor that we work on population estimates and projections for the state, and also participate in census partnership programs to ensure accurate and useful data for Alaska from the Census Bureau. The decennial census is the most important data set that we have to generate statistics about population. In addition to its constitutional mandate for reapportionment, it is the starting point for virtually all state and local population estimates in the country, and these estimates are used for funding allocations and in the development of countless reports and statistics. I should note that the U.S. Census Bureau manages many different surveys, many of which which are ongoing. The American Community Survey is an ongoing one that we rely on and talk about a lot. But when we talk about the census, we mean the decennial count of the entire U.S. population. The questionnaire for the decennial census is pretty brief, but the questionnaires must be filled in for every single household and living quarters in the country. And each of these households and living quarters must be tied to a certain place. This is a huge undertaking. The last census was 2010, of course, and the next one is 2020, so this is coming up very soon. So I have about 15 minutes of information prepared. I'll first provide some information on how the state uses the data, highlighting some resources that Alaska relies on, which are closely linked to the census. I'll then share information from the Census Bureau on data privacy and protection of respondents' data, and also some concerns I have about new data privacy protocol and how that might affect data availability in Alaska. Lastly, I'll discuss some challenges for ensuring complete 2020 counts in Alaska and some insights on what might help with these. So here are some different data resources on the slide that rely on decennial census data. We don't think about it very much, of course, but because all of our population estimates throughout the decade start with the census, countless other statistics are affected by it. Population estimates are used directly in the development of health statistics, education statistics, employment statistics. Our monthly unemployment rates rely on a good decennial census. Crime statistics, they're used in planning and forecast tools for transportation. They're used for housing statistics. In my experience, few representative socioeconomic data resources in the U.S. don't involve the data from the decennial census. And for small communities, and we have hundreds of these in Alaska, of course, the decennial census is often the only reliable source of demographic and household characteristics. When someone calls me to ask for data by age or by race for a small village in Alaska, I note the decennial census data as the preferred source. Sometimes we can rely on the American Community Survey, but due to small sample size, the data for small communities is often unreliable. Since decennial census data should represent a complete 100% count, they don't have the kinds of uncertainty that comes with other sources like the American Community Survey, and that especially affects data for small communities. So that's really underscoring that small communities in particular need that decennial count. We rely on it even now. I'm pointing people to the decennial data for their small communities, because the later data, if we need for these detailed demographic characteristics, they're not often as reliable. I also want to note here, though, it's very difficult to know or to correct or know how to correct errors in the decennial census, so it's especially important that the Census Bureau get the counts right. People ask sometimes about PFD-based population data. PFD-based data is helpful for population estimates in Alaska. Indeed, it's the only way that we can get reliable yearly total population estimates for hundreds of communities across the state, and these are sort of just the basic population estimates, but it does not cover everyone. Many military, students, recent movers to Alaska, as Representative Hannon discussed earlier, are not covered, and we must use it in conjunction with reliable decennial census data. I want to also note here, Ms. Skovic provided a great overview of 2020 census operations in her presentation, so I won't recover that ground here. Going forward, I hope we can learn more from the Census Bureau, and I think this is important, on how things are looking for recruiting. I hope that we can get sort of public comment on how things are looking for recruiting, budget, outreach, and non-response management, that going back when people don't respond. And for hiring, basically, how many people will be hired in Alaska by operation, if possible, and how does this compare to 2010? So turning to data privacy and protection, data privacy is something the Census Bureau especially emphasizes, and I think it's important to share some of their information on here today. The Census Bureau notes that under Title 13 of the U.S. Code, the Census Bureau cannot release any identifiable information about individuals, households, or businesses, even to law enforcement agencies. The law states that the information collected may only be used for statistical purposes and no other purposes. To support historical research, Title 44 of the U.S. Code allows National Archives and Records Administration to release data only after 72 years, individual records only after 72 years for historical research. We think of ancestry research often. All census staff take a lifetime oath to protect your personal information. These are quotes from the Census Bureau, I should say, this last one in particular. To protect your personal information, and any violation comes with a penalty of up to $250,000 or up to 5 years in prison. Related to data privacy and the strict protocol that the Census Bureau maintains, though, a new concern that's emerged over the last year and affects all states, but I think Alaska could be particularly affected, is recent work and planning by the Census Bureau related to something called disclosure avoidance. Disclosure avoidance is steps that the Census Bureau takes to ensure that tables they publish don't disclose information about individuals. So steps include standard methods such as data swapping and adding statistical noise for certain tabulations as needed to protect respondents' information. With the 2020 census, the Census Bureau is planning a use of a new method for disclosure avoidance. It's called differential privacy. So the Bureau notes that the transition to this new method is important to keep up with new threats to data security, but it's not clear to me at this stage how data for Alaska will be affected. Indeed, many data users across the country share similar concerns about the new differential privacy protocol. But for Alaska in particular, I think we need to learn from the Census Bureau. With a recent presentation for the Census Scientific Advisory Committee, the Census Bureau noted a challenge. Specifically, they noted a challenge they are working on is tabulating accurate and detailed demographic and housing characteristics for American Indian and Alaska Native tribes, Alaska Native villages, associations, communities, councils, and corporations. Additionally, Alaska is, of course, home to hundreds of communities with particularly small populations. These are, to the Census Bureau, small population is like less than 10,000 to many people throughout the country. But we have, you know, many communities with populations less than 500. And most, by far, of our populations under 5,000. So these communities are especially reliant on decennial census, as I mentioned earlier. So I hope we can learn more from the Census Bureau on how data quality and availability for these populations will be affected. Those more detailed tabulations are going to be affected more by the new disclosure avoidance protocol because they want to protect information. But does that mean we're going to get less data, or does it mean we're going to get less reliable data? Because small communities really need this information. I think it's something that we need to hear more from the Census Bureau about. Oh, sorry. Oh, so this is my data. This is the next slide. So here's looking at challenges for ensuring complete counts for the 2020 now. Some things I'm concerned about for 2020 census in Alaska are any impediments to hiring and training 2020 census employees. It is very difficult. These are going to be federally hired by federal government, and that's a very challenging process to get folks hired and meet all of the qualifications for federal government hiring. So any impediments to that I'm concerned about. Difficulty in finding and identifying housing units in Alaska, that's something that I hope is managed by strong hiring and people in the field, and also by outreach through post office boxes, if we can do that. Multifamily, including individuals and extended family arrangements, making sure everyone in the household is counted. So when they get the census form, that they're not just counting their sort of nuclear family, but everybody who is residing in the household. And distrust and fatigue related to the census and surveys in general. Communication challenges due to language barriers. For all areas in the state, to ensure complete count, I think it's critical that we find ways to engage Alaskans to respond and be counted. The Census Bureau has provided careful research. Ms. Govic discussed earlier a bit about the barriers, attitudes, and motivators for response to the census. It's not Alaska specific at all, but I think it's informative. From their survey, there's a survey about 50,000 households in 2018, nearly 18,000 response, or 35% response rate. Many people were unfamiliar with the census, and these are quotes from the work, with only 33% being extremely or very knowledgeable or familiar. Knowledge about the purpose and process of the census was uneven across groups. The analysis revealed five barriers that might prevent people from participating in the census. Concern about data privacy and confidentiality, fear of repercussions, distrust in all levels of government, feeling that it doesn't matter if you're counted, and belief that completing the census might not benefit you personally. It's another quote from funding by public services was a top motivator across groups, yet less than half of respondents knew that the census is used to determine community funding. And from their research on focus groups, this last piece, some quotes from this I think are helpful for Alaska. Tying participation in the census to community funding, and by extension, the hope and a better future for younger generations was a key motivator for response. Helping people understand the purpose, the content, and the process of the census may increase their participation in the 2020 census. Messaging is needed, the Census Bureau notes, for how the census directly benefits local communities now and in the future. Providing information about the Census Bureau's data protection policies alone will not mitigate the concerns around data privacy and confidentiality. Encouraging response from trusted voices within the community to make increased participation among people with the greatest distrust in government. This underscores, I think, the importance of complete count committees throughout the state, and I'm grateful to the work of the Census Bureau to stand up these committees throughout the state, and to the folks with the working group to get the word out about the census in Alaska for 2020, so that we, as all Alaskans, are knowing that this is a survey that we want to respond to ensure our communities are accurately funded through the next decade, represented in statistics, represented in government. I think the efforts here to ensure complete counts are very important for Alaska for the next decade. Thank you. On my contact.
Are there any questions from committee members? Representative Edgman?
I know time is getting short here, but just maybe I don't get to ask the state demographer questions every day, so.
Got my book of statistics here.
So just real quickly, Alaska, I think, is, according to your department, the most migratory state in the country. So we have more people coming and going every year. And if you look at a 10-year period, a census period, I think approximately half of the state's population turns over, something in that, or at least the last 10 years, just roughly speaking. But just, you know, give you a quick opportunity to say, how does that affect your job in terms of follow-up surveys relative to the census data, which, you know, over a period of years begins to sort of incorporate people who weren't counted but still are Alaska residents, but maybe, you know, sort of tabulated in the American Census Survey and other surveys that take place?
Yes. So for the household population, we rely heavily on data from permanent fund dividend applications. We do make an adjustment because of the high turnover in Alaska, and it takes between 1 and 2 years for someone to become eligible for a permanent fund dividend. So we make an adjustment to a statewide total that's based on IRS statistics from the Census Bureau. So we do something called a census ratio method, and we make the household estimates for all the communities in the state. And then we adjust that to an IRS-based data set, which doesn't have the sort of lag that the PFD has. But also, we have a lot of special populations that we do extra work on. So military are not as well covered in the permanent fund dividend because of the high turnover. And also, I think, because of outreach, we've seen some change, I think, in the rate of military applications for the PFD in recent years. But so we have special surveys to assess the number of military and their dependents in the state. We have special surveys to, or we have a special survey to try to assess the group quarters population. And when we can't get good data on group quarters population, we hold that fixed so we don't let it sort of be affected by the PFD to fluctuate when it shouldn't be. But it is a challenge. We are very fortunate in Alaska to have this incredible data set to help ensure accurate estimates. You know, its purpose isn't to help us ensure population estimates, but we are very grateful for it. I worked in Colorado for a few years, and we had to rely there on things like county level vehicle registrations and voting registrations. This is much less reliable, and we wouldn't get nearly as good a and other states don't have nearly as good a population estimates for their small communities. But it all hinges on the decennial census count. That's what we really need, and we in particular need good sub-county, they would call it the Census Bureau, but below the borough level and out in the unorganized borough, we particularly need estimates that reflect the population. We have sort of just because of the way our state is set up with the political entities, local government doesn't have much of our state doesn't have county level government. So we need accurate estimates for all of the cities.
Thank you.
Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How does the Census Working Group plan to count folks that are experiencing homelessness? Many of them don't even use PO boxes, they use general delivery addresses, so.
Through the chair, the census will count people in transitory locations on a designated day. We're actually working now to, we can provide information to the Census Bureau on known transitory locations, and we're hoping to work with the Alaska area manager to learn more, because Fairbanks, Anchorage, Juneau have homeless counts, and so they know these populations. And so we're hoping that that the Census Bureau can work with these. We want folks who are living in transitory locations to know that the census is coming too, and want to respect the counts that are done there. So I'm hoping that communication with the Census Bureau and the folks who are leading the homeless counts and counts at other transitory locations can be done.
I never knew that I would be so concerned or inspired by the census and making sure that there's quality data. It's easy to want to glaze over when you talk about the census, and so we really appreciate how accessible you all have made this information this morning and talking about the importance of federal investment in Alaska and why it's so important that we have accurate and fair counts at the front end. One thing that we haven't really discussed this morning, and I'm not sure that you can speak to this, but I'm just curious. I know that the I think it's the American Community Survey provides some socioeconomic data that hinges on some information from the census. Is that also done through the Census Bureau? And from what I understand, that's ongoing efforts. Can anybody speak to the ACS?
Yes. So the ACS depends very, very much on the decennial census, because all the population estimates come out of the start with the decennial census, and the ACS is weighted, adjusted to match the population estimates. So if those data for the population estimates are inaccurate, that sample that they use for the ACS isn't going to help. We're going to have inaccurate ACS data. And as it stands, for most of our communities, they can't use the ACS data because the sample is small enough that it doesn't, that the margins of error, the statistical sort of error that comes with the data, it is so large that you can't really use the data. So that's why I'm particularly concerned that we get all of our tabulations from the census, all of our data from the decennial census for Alaska. We will be in a bad spot through the next decade if we don't, so that's why I'm concerned about that differential privacy issue. If we don't get those tabulations, the complete tabulations, I'm not sure what I can tell communities as far as how, you know, household relationship information, race and ethnicity characteristics. We won't have it because the ACS relies on the census relies on the decennial census for that, and it's in the ACS we for small populations we can't really use. Sometimes I tell people pull them together and we can try to reduce the error, but then it's not that community. It's 10 communities, so it doesn't really help.
And from what I understand, the ACS, so the example that I've heard following the 2010 census was a Western Alaska village that was estimated to have a median income of some 70,000, but that was because there was all of the individuals counted in that sample happened to be employed, so it doesn't accurately reflect the socioeconomic information. Can you speak, Mr. Hunsinger, to how the ACS information is used, just briefly?
Yes, Chair Zolkowski, that is an ongoing problem. That's an active problem that doesn't have any sort of solution or any way to address it right now, that in the ACS data, which is the only data you're gonna find for median household income for many, there's this county business patterns and there's some other data sets that may help, but a lot of time we have to go to the ACS data to get sort of complete information. And we don't have a resolution or a way to solve that problem yet as far as getting reliable income information. Even pulling 5 years of data together, which the Census Bureau does for the ACS for these communities, it's not enough. The sample is so small. So that's an ongoing challenge. So that's why if we lost, not having that, if we also lost our basic demographic characteristics, any of that information is going to be tough for Alaska in particular. Other states don't have so many communities with, you know, less than 500 people. It's not even on other states' radar, that issue. But they're also very concerned about this differential privacy issue.
And is that information typically by communities for grant applications, or I guess I'm just hoping to better understand maybe in a couple of sentences how the ACS data is used by communities and why it's important that it's accurate.
Yes, I think so it's used, I would say, health statistics, crime statistics, employment statistics. Often we get people call in, they'll want to complete a grant. I can't speak to all of the different kinds of grants, but pretty much if somebody needs socioeconomic data in Alaska, you need a good decennial census, or you need, and oftentimes they need the ACS, and a lot of time we have to work with what we have. You know, I advise people to look at the margins of error and make sure that the person that they're applying, the grant they're applying to, that they make that known to the person administering the grant to give them the benefit of the doubt. But yeah, that's definitely an ongoing issue.
Representative Vance.
Thank you. Excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chair. I have one question and one statement. Let's talk about the trust and the issue of data privacy. You know, you showed in there that the federal government can't use this data for anything else other than statistical information and things like that. But one of the larger fears now is the cybersecurity. You know, here in the state, the Matsu Borough had, you know, a breach. We've had national levels where, you know, hackers were able to access information. It's become, unfortunately, a regular part of our lives. What type of cybersecurity does the federal government have that would cause Alaskans to feel a little bit more comfortable with their data going to be, you know, tabulated for a very long amount of time?
Through the chair, I can say this. The Census Bureau has been a leader for data privacy and confidentiality and managing respondents' information. That's one reason that they this differential privacy sort of method that they want to use is a cutting-edge method, but yeah, it can affect data for data availability. I can't speak to sort of the technical aspects of how the Census Bureau manages data privacy, but in my experience and sort of my peers also recognize that the Census Bureau has done a very good job as far as managing data privacy and data confidentiality. I'm always concerned, as I'm sure all Alaskans are, about that. It is a very brief form, so it's basic demographic characteristics for the household. It doesn't have anything like social security numbers or anything like that. But I think, you know, I think Alaskans should weigh that there is sort of risk in the world. But I do think the Census Bureau has shown that they manage respondents' data very, very well, strictly.
Follow up. So you also mentioned, or did I hear it correctly, that after 72 years, the census information will be made available to the public?
Yes, that's correct. Yes, through the chair, that's correct.
Has that been a common practice over the years?
Yes, through the chair, that's correct. That's so if you think of like Ancestry.com and things like mm-hmm. that, where you can go and see that. So the last one, I think, is 1940 census is the latest available, and you can see sort of individual records and learn about your family tree if your family was in the census at that time.
One more follow-up statement. Yes, ironically, that is where I came across how valuable the census data information is, and I find it interesting that I'm reluctant because of privacy, feeling like it's an invasion of my privacy. But I found some family that I could not find anywhere else. There was one military record that clued that my mom was named after her dad's sister that no one knew existed, and it was from a census that we found that she did exist, what household she lived in, and I was able to kind of create a timeline to know that this person existed, and it was my mother's namesake. So it completely made a difference in her life and the value, and that was about 100 years ago. So when we think about the information being used in the future to help locate a piece of our history and our identity, you know, it becomes so much more than just gaining federal dollars for our state. So, you know, it's interesting when you kind of bring it all together, the value that this could mean for us in the future.
Through the chair, I just offer to, I think the U.S. Census Bureau staff have been wonderfully forthcoming in talking about privacy issues, and I'd encourage you to, and we're happy to try to connect you to local Census Bureau staff who could also answer some of your more specific questions that we can't answer.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, through the chair. And I'm going to postulate a question and understand I have no authority to do this, but if I were queen for the day and had $1 million to appropriate in the state's budget to address our census concerns, where should it be allocated? Into one agency? Should it be specified, you know, 500,000 for translation of outreach documents? Give me some guidance in fairly specific terms, if you can, as to if we were dreaming big, how do we ideally meet these concerns that you've raised, and where do those appropriations go?
Thank you. Through the chair, I think through the working group, we've identified some of the sort of top priority budget items that we would turn to, one of those being translation. The sort of very lean estimate for that, I believe, was $30,000, but that's sort of on the low end of just what will we sort of scrape by with, and so bolstering that in some way, I think, would be important. We've also talked about sub-granting, like mini-grants to local communities that are forming CCCs, so if you're having a meeting and you need to print flyers or you need food to sort of get people in the room talking about census, how can we create, and we know that food is the primary driver for getting people in the room to talk about census, but just figuring out sort of putting those resources at the local level. If the whole idea is that trusted local messaging is what's important and organizing people in their communities is important, then how are we actually providing resources to do that? And so that would be another big piece. And then you start to get into things that are actual outreach materials. So communications plans cost money to put together, or at least a lot of time to put together. And then what are we actually doing in terms of, do we want to have a P.O. box mailer that's actually reaching people where they are? And that comes with a pretty hefty price tag, I believe, of a couple $100,000 at sort of the bare minimum. And so those are some of the main pieces that we've outlined. You then get into a communications plan that could include radio ads and things like that. And so there are other items beyond our bare minimum budget that we could also sort of dream with you on where we would get to $1 million, but those are the main components, and Lori might add to that.
Yeah, thank you, through the chair. I would just say, through the working group, we've asked a similar question, and, for example, we've heard from librarians across the state who would create kiosks in their libraries. We've heard from local schools who would do lots of local educate children and get them excited, so then they'd get their parents excited because children are super hard to count. So, I mean, I think we don't lack ideas. We're happy to share with you the budget that we've created based on lots of those good ideas. But again, all of our ideas are all about the outreach and the education that happens before the census. So I do think that there's resources that could be used during the census as well. We would defer to the Census Bureau and have conversations with you about that that piece of them as well. So our effort is really about the education that happens before the count. Then there's lots of work that happens around the count themselves. I think, one of the things that we're hearing, again, is that the Bureau themselves, while there are lovely, we think about 1,000 jobs on the line here that the Census Bureau will hire before the end of this count, and they are pretty, they do pay well, that's wonderful, but the problem is that it's getting people to apply, to know that those jobs are available, to then walk the federal process of getting that job. There's lots of work around job readiness and job preparedness as well.
Follow up, Representative Hannon.
Thank you, and I guess, and again, don't want to lead you on because I don't have the authority to produce $1 million and add it into the operating budget, but this is affirmed for me that we are talking about needing it in this operating budget, because although we talk about the 2020 census, Tuxic Bay, January 21st, and it's about the outreach and education that needs to be happening now and through the fall, and I guess I'm a little fearful that we're behind the curve, and I haven't heard nor asked that specific question, have we put money into the budget, and I doubt we have, because we've been talking about cutting things that we didn't have in last year's budget, and I'm sure we didn't have it in last year's budget. So reaching back to 10 years ago's operating budget has me very fearful that we're going to be at a 10% undercount in the 2020 census if we are as frugal as we talk publicly, forgetting that cutting off our nose to spite our face. We're frugal this year, but we've cost ourselves 10 years of federal contributions to money that needs to be serving Alaskans. So thanks for sounding the alarm, but hope we can meet this need.
Representative Jackson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I want to work off of what was just said. I don't know if we missed the fact that the federal dollars are shrinking also, because we're not getting as much coming in to do this process as we used to. right? So there's a shortage, not just here with us being frugal, it's everywhere. So, and to add to your queen for a day, you might want to get a group of bounty census hunters, because we have more communities that intentionally live off the grid. Is that right? Well, that's right. So people come up from the lower 48 to go and live off the grid and not be found, right? So you would need a group of intentional hunters to go find them. Thank you for your presentation. It's been great.
I would be concerned that maybe, as Representative Vance said, they might be chased off of some property. Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm glad to hear you you say that you work with the schools. I know schools also do a lot of translation, because their kids come to school needing to communicate home with their parents and so on and so forth. And I'm sure you already know that, but they're probably translating a lot more languages now than they did 10 years ago.
Yes, thanks, through the chair. Thank you. Our hope is to work directly with schools and libraries, and also Division of Election translators. And we're uncovering every opportunity we can to maximize that effort.
Go ahead.
Through the chair, just to emphasize too that the Census Bureau actually has staff, which they call partnership specialists, and they have both tribal partnership specialists and just sort of their general partnership specialists. And those staff members are tasked with making those connections. They're out talking to libraries and schools and all of that. So in that sense, we've had definitely a partner in the Census Bureau trying to think of those more innovative ways you connect.
I want to recognize that we are wrapping up, but I do, we've heard a lot this morning about translation support for Alaska Native languages, but I anticipate in larger urban centers in Alaska that there's a significant immigrant population that also need translation support. Is that correct?
Squeeze in a question.
Yep. Representative Edgman.
So I wanted to ask about Alaska Native tribes, and knowing that, correct me if I'm wrong, 2000 I think was the first census that ever allowed for a person to sort of delineate that they were mixed races, like Caucasian and Alaska Native. But was that the first year as well that Alaska Native tribes were part of the census accounting process?
Through the chair, I will have to look back and follow up, Representative. I am trying to think. So there were village statistical areas prior to then that the Census Bureau worked with tribal governments, I believe. So I believe the Census Bureau is working with tribal governments prior to 2000, but I have to follow up. Is that helpful? Or?
Follow up.
Through the chair, I think providing that information to the committee would be helpful. Yes. And then the other question I'd like to maybe have you come back with the information on later is the American Census Survey or any other surveys that help count Alaska Native tribes, or sort of, you know, build a model of where we can you know, understand their demographic profile a bit more than what we might know at this point. I know this is a very sort of involved question, because from the non-for-profit sector, for example, Laura, you probably, you know, can respond to it as well, but it just seems to me that we have a building understanding of Alaska Native tribes and what they mean in the smaller communities, what they mean as the state as a whole. But that profile isn't quite there yet, or certainly has a lot of work to be done to complete it.
Can I say, through the chair, and the Census Bureau works independently with tribal governments, so independent from working with the state. They also have ongoing relationship with the interaction with the tribal governments. And I just wanted to also take an opportunity before I lose it to say I am so grateful to the folks. The Census Bureau, it is a very challenging time, I am sure, for federal government and for because they do have, it seems, less resources right now. And I am so thankful to the Census Bureau for the work that they've done in Alaska. And I hope that they're energized to help ensure that we get complete counts for 2020.
Through the chair, just to sort of elaborate on your question, there was discussion ahead of this 2020 census about adding a tribal enrollment question, which was specifically going to ask people to fill out their tribe. And specifically in going around Alaska, a lot of concern was raised around what does that mean for the individual actually filling out that form? If you're a shareholder of a regional corporation, if you're part of a village corporation, if you have you're part of you have a tribal identifier or an ethnic sort of connection that you would list there. And there were so many different ways that a person could answer that question, especially in Alaska, that it was clear that that data was going to be confusing and unhelpful to sort of aggregate that and understand what it means if you have one person putting down their regional corporation, their native corporation, one person putting down a village affiliation, and then you would get very messy data out of that. And so there was a lot of pushback, and one of the things that the Census Working Group did early on was push back against adding that question before it has been sort of rigorously tested and ensured that that would be helpful information and not detract from sort of the intention of adding something. But is not included on this 2020 census form.
And this is, through the chair, this is something that the Census Bureau has had meetings with tribal governments and tribal stakeholders at AFN in Alaska, and so they've certainly been interacting.
So can I just quickly follow up? I'm a little confused by your response because looking at the census data, the census test on number 9, it says list your tribe, your enrolled or principal tribes. So that seems to kind of contradict what you were just saying a moment ago.
Through the chair. So my understanding is that that is not actually used in things like funding formulas. So right now, for example, the Indian Housing Block Grant does not use that tribal identifier to actually shift funding. It's something that's included, and Mr. Hunsinger can speak more to this for sort of census cross-tabulations and trying to map that out, but is not actually driving funding allocations the way that having a separate question I think was proposed that it would. And so I think that's the piece that's different. There are still a lot of questions and a lot of outreach that we've identified around creating some sort of fact sheet that helps people understand how best to respond to that question, sort of an order of operations of your regional corporation versus whatever your sort of identifiers might be and how you answer the tribal question on there, but it doesn't carry the same weight. And Mr. Hunsinger can maybe elaborate on that.
Yes, through the chair. So the Census Bureau has to meet certain OMB criteria for race and ethnicity, but they also can try and get some more information that are useful for tabulations throughout the decade. And now thinking back, and I will follow up to confirm, but I believe in the questionnaires prior to 2000 that along with the American Indian Alaska Native designation that there was sort of a fill-in of for more information, such as I will have to follow up on that. This census, there's sort of changes from census to census in the race question. It's sort of interesting to look over the long term for sure. This would have been what they were thinking about doing was a separate additional question for tribal enrollment, and that's something that, to my knowledge, is not in the plans anymore at all.
Representative Jackson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the tribal funds that we get, do we get funded federally for the tribal Indian? Do they do that by population or there's a set amount that we get?
I can attempt to answer that question. That's going to change dependent on the subject area that's being funded. Tribal health funding is funded differently from particular block grants for, say, Native American housing, which is going to be different than social service entities that provide support for nonprofit tribal social service entities. So it depends on what avenue that funding is being funded through. Mm-hmm. Thank you all so much for coming and presenting before our committee today, for answering our litany of questions. That was probably the fastest 2 hours I've ever spent talking about data in my life. This Thursday, April 25th, the House Special Committee on Tribal Affairs will be hearing SB 78, which looks to establish Katie John Day in Alaska, as well as a resolution urging the U.S. Congress to fully fund the U.S. Census Bureau and additional considerations related to the issues that we heard today. The time is 9:47 a.m., and this joint hearing of the House Special Committee on Tribal Affairs and Community and Regional Affairs is now adjourned.